Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale.
And he says, well, let's take it head on. He says, I think I'm ready for this. So they take it head on. And the pitch of the boat was so great that Clyde lost grip of the oars and was actually pitched out of the boat. And they hit those diminishing waves as they went through. But he was out of the boat and managed to climb back in the boat and in a very exhausted state and grabbed the oars. And the guy up front turned around and said, boy, Clyde, you did that really well.
That was Roger Fletcher sharing a great drift boat story about one of my favorite rapids to run. And the drift boat season continues on. This is the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today. We'll help you on your fly fishing journey with classic stories covering steelhead fishing, fly tying, and much more.
Hey, how's it going today? Thanks for stopping by the Fly Fishing Show. I would love if you could leave feedback or a question for the show. You can easily do this by heading over to wetflyswing.com/speak. Speak, that's S-P-E-A-K. That'll take you to the Speak Pipe page where you can leave a voice review. And I will post that, if I can, on the on an upcoming podcast so you can hear your voice coming up here. I'm hoping we can get a few of these and check it out. So head over there now just to let me know it's working. That'd be awesome. Roger Fletcher, a leading authority in drift boat history and design, is here to share the story of how drift boats came to be. We find out who was the most important person in the history of drift boats and why. Find out how the Grand Canyon Dory came to be and hear about that whole history there. Pretty exciting, pretty amazing stuff. We also dig into a little bit of Roger's exact replica models that he does, which are pretty amazing. So today, drift boats, and a little river dory is what's on tap for you. Hey, before we get started, I just want to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode. The Fly Fishing and Tying Journal is our sponsor, and they're doing a great job over there. If you want to check out what they have going, head over to wetflyswing.com/FTJ and see what the newest edition is right now. Here is Roger Fletcher from riverstouch.com. How's it going, Roger?
It's going well, thank you.
Thanks for coming on today. This is I've been doing a little bit of research in preparation for this drift boat season that I'm doing. And it's pretty exciting to have you on here because I feel like you're probably one of the best people, you know, maybe in the world to talk to about the history, which is what I want to dig in. You have a book called Drift Boats and River Dories, and it's a really good book. I've read, a good chunk of it, and I'd like to hear about the history, but maybe you can just start us off. Tell us how how did this all start? How do you become the, drift boat guru?
Well, probably as much by chance as anything else. I've been in the world of drift boats for the last, can't believe this, 60 years. And my daughters grew up on the oars of a drift boat, and I became attracted to them because they are such a beautiful piece of work that I love the lines of a drift boat, but also because of the navigability of the boat on rivers. And so it took me a little while to develop the skills, but when I did, I haven't been able to leave the sticks alone. Although in recent years, because of age and other factors, get out a lot less than I did then. So Anyway, my drift boating experience has been basically on the coastal rivers here, the Nestucca, the Siletz, primarily, and then the Deschutes over in Central Oregon, and the Rogue River, one of my favorite places for fly fishing. I really like the Deschutes, and for just running whitewater, I really enjoy the Rogue River. Drift boats were my escape during my professional career, and we would get out with the family three or four times a summer, and then I would get out more frequently as I was had the time and energy. And I began looking at my passion as something that I might recreate as fine furniture. If you can imagine a drift boat coffee table or a model of your favorite boat on your desk as a reminder of some of the fun times you've had on the river. And so I've always enjoyed working with wood. And so my intention was to, upon my retirement, to do just that. I built a 1,200 square foot shop about 10 years before I retired, and started working with wood on a number of different things. But when I started looking at plans for drift boats, they basically were unavailable. Drift boat builders, as one can appreciate because there are so few of them, are fairly proprietary in their in availing plans of their boats. They far prefer to build a boat for you or provide a kit, but to provide the plans in order to build the boat, you just couldn't find them. So that led me to figure out how I could address that that question. How do I get all of some plans for these things? What I discovered was that there's a history to these boats. And the most profound piece of history, as far as I'm concerned, is that these boats were spawned on two Oregon rivers, the drift boats on the McKenzie River and the River Dories, the Rogue River Dory down on the Rogue River. And those spawning grounds gave rise to an evolution of boats that brought us to where the typical boat type that we see navigating rivers today are those, either one of those two rivers. And so that history, because of my background in research and education, my curiosity got the better of me. And beginning about 1994, 95, I began to explore the history of these boats. And the short story is that over the next 12 years, I researched the origin. What I tried to do is to find key points in time where there were key changes in the boat that led to additional changes over time to what we have today, which people consider to be the traditional McKenzie River drift boat. And if you're Colorado River oriented, the Colorado River Dory, which incidentally was spawned on the McKenzie and the Rogue River. And so all this led to a book that was published by Stackpole Books, which at that time in 1995, 96, 97 was the leading fly fishing publishing house in the country, and it still may be. I don't know that, but that led to their publishing my book Drift Boats and River Dories in 2007, 13 years ago, and it basically chronicles the research that I've done, and that's in three basic areas: the lives of the people behind the boats as they evolved over time. Beginning back in the 1800s, early 1900s. A detailed chapter on how the boats are built. And then the biggest project had to do with recovering the lines and the construction detail of these boats at each point of evolution. And that was a very onerous task, very enjoyable, but just lots of work. And it took anywhere from 300 to 500 hours per boat. Hmm. And I recovered the lines on 13 different boats, 10 of which are published in the book. So it's this crazy passion I have for these boats that led to me spending an inordinate amount of time in researching the origins, recovering the lines and construction detail of the boats, and And then there was sufficient interest on the part of actually four publishers invited me to submit the manuscript to them for consideration, three of whom wanted to publish the book. And I went with Stackpole primarily because they're a fly fishing publishing house. And it seemed to me that that would be an audience that might have the greatest interest in the boat, because the Mackenzie River Drift Boat in particular evolved because guides and fishermen on that river were looking for a fishing, a stable fishing platform, fly fishing platform. So it's kind of a long-winded
great.
Litany of how I got into this.
That's great. Yeah, no, I mean, as you talk, and like I said, I read the main, the history chapter, I guess, in your boat. And so we can dig into that. There's a bunch of people, you know, Jerry Briggs and Martin Linton and all sorts of big names that helped the process. And actually, I do want to highlight, just because I've been to Colorado, you know, I'm lining up about 12 other guests to talk about, to keep furthering the conversation on drift boats. And it's interesting because the Colorado, I've kind of been addicted to these videos. I've been watching these drift boats going down the Colorado and some of them flipping in these rapids. Because I've, like you, the Rogue has been the most extreme whitewater I've ever taken a drift boat down through. And I always think of that. But this Colorado is a whole other level. I mean, the stuff that they're going through is crazy. And I just, you know, it's like, it's my goal, you know, one of my life goals that I want to go down that river and run a dory in some way. But, you know, talk about that a little bit, the difference between, I guess we got that right. We got the whole dory thing, which was the decked over boats, which is a little bit different. Where would you like to start? Would you like to talk about that a little bit? Or do you want to go all the way back to the beginning before there were drift boats?
Well, one short story. Before there were drift boats on the Mackenzie, the boat of choice, and they started guiding the river down. Phillip by the name of Milo Thompson is the first person to have taken a person down the river for hire, for pay, to fish. And the boat he used was came to be known as the Old Scow. And 22 feet long, 3 feet across the bottom line of the boat, chine to chine. And with a very, very low profile. And these guides, as they evolved, would use that boat. And it was the boat of choice simply because it was the only boat they had up until about 1925. And so picture this, fell on the oars, this 22-foot, really cumbersome, heavily timbered relic of a boat. And the fly fisher standing on a platform in the at the transom of the boat, fly fishing. As the guide moves the boat through class two, they'd slip around class three water, try to at least. But fly fisher standing on a platform that sits about 3 or 4 inches below the gunwale of the boat on the downriver end, looking for pockets and fly fishing as he goes along. I showed some pictures to the Intermountain Guides Association over on the Snake River a few years ago, and one old grizzled guide looked at that picture and he said, "My gosh, they don't make fly fishermen like that anymore."
That's just right.
So anyway, well, back to the Mackenzie's and Rogues and Colorado. When you look at a Rogue River dory and a Mackenzie River dory or drift boat, to the untrained eye, they look very much the same. There are some differences that are considerable that cause the boats to perform very differently. The Mackenzie River drift boat has a continuous rocker fore to aft, and that design provides great maneuverability through really busy, bony water. The Rogue River dory, as it evolved down on the Rogue, has a very straight bottom line. Typically, and on the traditional boat, that bottom line has about a 60-inch flat spot fore to aft. And that means the chine, a greater extent of the bottom of the boat is in contact with the water, as opposed to the Mackenzie boat, where less of that chine is in contact with the water. That's why there's more maneuverability on the Mackenzie River drift boat, less so on the Rogue River dory. That means that on running a rapid, if you were to lose an oar on a Rogue River dory, that boat has a greater chance of maintaining its true course until you can get a spare oar in the oar lock. And it's one of the reasons that boat has become the boat of choice on the Colorado. Martin Litton in 1962 visited the McKenzie Whitewater Parade. And he was interested. He heard about these McKenzie River drift boats. And he came in contact with a drift boat builder by the name of Keith Steele. And Keith, after they visited, and Martin made clear what he was looking for in a boat for the Colorado, Keith built two boats for him. And those two boats were in use on the Colorado until he met Jerry Briggs in, gosh, it had to be 1968, 1969. I think the first boats that Briggs built for Martin were in 1970 or 71. And those boats, like the boats that Keith Steele built for Martin, had a very straight chine line. And considerable contact with the water. And the value of that to someone navigating a river like the Rogue is that once you hit that line, you have greater likelihood of being able to maintain that line because of that straight chine. It can also be problematic if you've got to do some quick pivoting and pulling because they're not as maneuverable as a traditional McKenzie River drift boat. But Martin so loved those boats that he asked Keith to build a couple more for him. And Keith was a very prolific boat builder and boasted that he could build a boat in a day. And so Martin ordered up a couple more boats and called him from his home in Palo Alto. Are the boats ready yet? He says, well, Yeah, they are. And Keith's idea was that he could get on those boats and have them built in just a very short period of time. And unbeknownst to Keith, Martin shows up at his door two or three days later, only to learn that he hadn't even started on the boats. And he was so disappointed that he just kind of, Martin, kind of left in a huff. And he's driving down old 99. Well, let's see, this would have been on I-5 at that point. And he gets to Grants Pass and he sees a sign out in the freeway. It says Rogue River Boat Shop. And so he pulls off and he looks for the Rogue River Boat Shop. And there he met Jerry Briggs. Jerry is a very jovial, affable, gregarious kind of person. They apparently hit it off fairly quickly, and out in the outside the shop, they were with a stick and some dust. Jerry remembers it as being drawing the thing out in dust. Martin remembers it as doing it in mud. The two recollections were a little bit different. But Jerry agreed to build a couple of boats for him, and that led to Jerry building, I think it was 35. Boats. Wow. For the Colorado, each one carrying a different name that Martin assigned to the boats. And his interest was in representing those boats as environmental places like Diablo Canyon and Glen Canyon.
Marble Canyon is the best one. There's the actual movie, right?
Yeah. So that's the two boats, the McKenzie and the Rogue River Dories, look very similar, but there are significant differences in how they function because the Rogues have just basically little rocker.
Yeah. Okay. So, and I have a bunch of questions. We'll dig into more of this here. But one of them, I guess, right off the start is the difference between the steel boat versus the Briggs boat. Was steel more of the McKenzie style, or what was the difference between those two?
Yes. Yeah. Keith built McKenzie style boats.
Okay.
But for Martin, he built two boats that I've got it. There's a picture in the book of Martin holding a Keith Steele boat, one of the first two that Keith built back in 1961 for him. And you can tell a very straight chine line, fore to aft. And that chine line is basically makes for a flat bottom boat. So Keith's boats were not typical McKinsey boat. Oh, okay. They were specifically built for Martin to address the unique.
How did they know that? Did like Martin know that, or did Steele? How did they know to keep the boat 60 inches flat before the Briggs boat started?
That's a good question. And I don't have an answer to that, because in my interviews with Martin, and Keith is long gone. He passed away back in the mid-70s.
Martin's still alive, right?
No, he died. No. Okay. Three or four years ago.
Oh, that's
ago,
right.
At the age of 97.
Wow.
And a wonderful character.
Yeah.
My goodness.
I'll put a link to the video, and I interviewed Pete McBride, who did some documentaries, and I'm actually going to have some more. I've got, like I said, a couple more. One of the Dory Grand Canyon boat builders is coming on, as well as hopefully Kevin Fedarko, who wrote the Emerald Mile. But yeah, so I'm interested in this McKinsey versus the Rogue, because, you know, obviously it's the big thing in drift boats, the big difference. But yeah, like you said, most people can't tell the difference, the rocker versus more of a flat bottom boat. I mean, can you talk? I mean, people will know of boats today. And I asked this, I just recently interviewed Joe Koffler, who's one of our big aluminum boats. And, you know, do you know, like Koffler, for example, are they McKinsey or Rogue style? Or do you know all that about the current boats?
Well, most Koffler, Clackercraft. As you look at the profile, if you see a continuous rocker fore to aft, that mimics the McKinsey River style. If you see a flat spot fore to aft of some distance, anywhere from 2 or 3 or 4 feet to 5 feet, 6 feet, I would say that mimics more of the Rogue River style.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. So it's easy. You can just look at the boat. And there's a bunch of boats too. I've been talking to some of the Idaho. Well, I mean, you've got the wood boats, you know, you got Raised River Dories, and then you got these Idaho, like RO boats. There's a bunch of like wood and fiberglass boats out of there that are different. Some of them are actually not even, they have the flat front, you know, so they're more of a pram, I guess, than they are a drift boat. But do you consider those, are those still considered drift boats? Those kind of those more like fishing type pram looking boats?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. In fact, the original McKinsey drift boat had a flat square transom, and they would navigate the river transom first, and it worked really well. The only problem, you get into really heavy water, it could lead to causing the boat to stall out if you didn't have enough momentum to go over a haystack or something like that. Yeah. Any boat that will safely contain a fly fisher or other angler on a river that has a link to the McKinsey, I don't know why you wouldn't call them a drift boat.
A drift boat. Well, and it's interesting with the drift boat versus like your book title, Drift Boats and River Dories. I just, before we got on, I Googled up, you know, drift boat at River Dory. River Dory has about, I think it's like 80, you know, pretty low. I mean, basically the order of magnitude higher in drift boat searches on Google is like two orders of, you know, it's like 9,000 versus 90. So why did drift, you know what I mean?
You mean the river doors show up exponentially more than drift boat?
No, the opposite. Saying? If you Google up, if you type in drift boat right now, it shows up two orders of magnitude higher than if you Googled river dory. So there's like no comparison. That drift boat seems like it's the one people are searching for. Do you see why did river dories not get, especially since you got the Grand Canyon? How did drift boat stick?
Yeah, tradition. I had a long discussion with a lot of the old guides on the McKinsey and also Jerry Briggs and some of the older fellows down there. The nomenclature on these boats really is tied to tradition. The McKinsey River drift boat is a river dory. A fellow by the name of John Gardner, a boat aficionado who died a number of years ago, wrote a book that was published in 1984 called The Dory Book. And he carefully makes a distinction between a dory and boats of other type. dory basically is a flat bottom boat, has straight sides. In other words, there's no there are no knuckles to the side of the boats, straight sides. And he called the McKenzie River drift boat the McKenzie River dory, and he was taken to task by a number of people out of the out of the McKenzie River area, saying, "Oh no, they're drift boats." And I think the reason they're called drift boats is because in order to navigate the river, you've got to go from one point to the other. These aren't intended to run back upstream. And so the notion of drifting from here to there, at some point in the mid-40s, they came to be known as drift boats.
Okay.
And why or how that stuck it is speculation, but in visiting with a number of the old guides down there when I was doing my research, that's how it's been known, and it's that tradition that has stuck. But McKenzie River drift boat is, by definition, according to Gardner and some others, Chappelle, who's a boat historian of some consequence, would call the drift boat a dory. So they, you know, the distinction between the McKenzie River drift boat and a Rogue River dory is why it's called. To me, it's basically the tradition of the area and has come to be known as such. And I don't have a better explanation than that, Dave.
That makes sense. No, it makes total sense. I think it's just... Yeah, I mean, the drift boat stuck, and that's you know, you still have the Grand Canyon dories, which, again, if we have time, I want to talk, touch a little more on some of that history, because, like you said, Martin Linton is this old guy who was a really cool figure. But let's take us back. Let's go all the way back, because, and you mentioned this a little bit, that, you know, these heavily wooded, very dense boats that kind of don't look a lot like a drift boat. Let's think back in history. I know in your book you touch on a few of these big names and turning points. Can we start back? Just take us to the start, you know, maybe from that, whatever you call that first drift boat when it came on the scene. Who was the person? Where did it all begin? Is there one person?
Well, in terms of guiding the McKenzie, my research and the best of my knowledge, the first person to take a person down the McKenzie for hire was a fellow by the name of Milo Thompson. The Thompson family is well known as Thompson without a P, T-H-O-M-S-O-N. Basically was using the boat that was typical on that river for farmers and other people to cross the river back and forth. Just a traditional old rowboat. These boats, the one that he used and became the customary boat for guides that came to life after realized that there was some money to be made here by taking people down the river for hire. And that's in part because there was a fairly fully hot springs. It was a place on the upper McKenzie that was a lodge to which moneyed people out of Seattle, San Francisco, some as far away as Chicago, would come and spend two or three or four weeks. It's kind of therapeutic, hot spring, whatnot. And these moneyed people discovered that there were fish in the river, and how do we get some fishing done? And that's where the guiding actually started. On the McKenzie. So the first time was 1910. There were a number of guides like John and Roy West, Prince Helfrich, that were using this boat that by the end of the day, they were so darn tired, bone tired, that it never really occurred to them to think about using or developing some other design to accommodate the uniqueness of the McKenzie. Until a fellow by the name of Velty Pruitt, who was born in Arkansas, but raised down on the Rogue at Merlin, and went to school in Eugene, connected with the McKenzie, and he built an old scow. He called it the old scow, and he built this thing, but like everybody else, by the end of the day, was so darn tired. Working your shoulders off to keep that boat navigable on the river. that he decided to try to do something different. And at one of the mills, there was a fellow by the name of Tom Karhus, who migrated here from Norway, who he and Vilti were friends. And Vilti asked him if he'd be willing to mill some planks for him, at least a foot wide and half to 3/8 to a half inch in thickness. And he was able to take this material, and he built a small light, I call it a light board and batten boat, that was less than 13 feet long, had a 3-foot breadth amidships at the chine, and it was highly maneuverable. So he built this thing and began to use it. One of the guides, a fellow by the name of Prince Hilfrich, spotted Velti. This would be about 1925. With that little boat, and he had seen him on the river a few times. And Prince was serving up lunch to one of his to his customers, and he was using the old scow, and he saw Velti go by, and he hailed him over and visit with him, and Velti offered to let him take the boat out and give it a try. And so he went out, and he was just very impressed. Short story is that Velti built a boat for Prince, and this led to a friendship that emerged between these two. And with that light board and batten boat, they not only ran the Mackenzie with great dexterity, they also and were the first to run the Metolius, the Crooked, the Deschutes, the Rogue from Prospect to Shady Cove, and run these wild rivers in these small boats. And their interest was in exploring fishing opportunities, and the boat provided them that opportunity. In about 1934-35, a fellow by the name of Woody Heinemann moved into the area from the panhandle of Texas. And he was an outdoors person. He was a cowboy and a cook for on a big ranch in New Mexico, just west of, or excuse me, east of his home in McLean, Texas. And he became very enamored by the river and went to work for a person by the name of Tom Karhus, learned how to build these boats. And he was the one primarily responsible for what we see as the contemporary Mackenzie style today. 1939, he built a 14-foot double ender. Up until that point, the boats had these broad transoms on them. And that was true for Velti Pruitt's boat also. And Woody built these boats, became very good friends with the guides, and introduced this Mackenzie type of boat that came to be known in the early to mid 40s as a drift boat. It wasn't until 1948, after the war, that the boat that you see today, the double ender with a transom, Mackenzie double ender with a transom, came to life. And Woody had been building these boats he started building boats in about 1935, but didn't build his first double ender until August of 1939. And then from then that's all he built were double enders.
Hmm. What is a double? Just describe a double ender and also what the transom is really quick.
All right. The double ender, true double ender is you have a stem and a stern post and no transom per se. The transom came to life in 1948. At the hands of Woody Heinemann, something he didn't want to do. But one of the guides said, I want to be able to hang a motor on this boat.
Right.
And down through the slower water of the Siusla and the Rogue with a motor. And so we built the boat, and Woody was against the idea. But that is the boat type that has come to be known as the traditional Mackenzie River drift boat.
So it wasn't, the transom wasn't created for more gear storage. It was created mainly for a motor, because I think now, you know, when you think a drift boat having a double ender would be cool for whitewater because you could go back, you know, backwards or forward, doesn't matter, right? But
right.
Are there other things to be thinking about there?
Well, originally it was in order to hang a motor on it. It's that boat type that has stuck since then. And it does create greater carrying capacity. A fellow by the name of Ray Heater, Ray's River Dories, one of the boats that he has been enamored with over the years is a minor adaptation to the original Mackenzie Drift boat that evolved with Vilty Pruitt and Tom Carhus, has that large transom and a 14-foot Rapid Robert, he calls it. Actually has greater carrying capacity than the 16-foot traditional Mackenzie River drift boat with a transom.
Is that the one that gets the rapid? Is it rapid? It's not Rapid Robber. It's is that the one that gets up on step with a motor?
Yeah, yeah, it is, and it's called it's called a Rapid Robert. Robert, yeah, without an S. Tom Carhus made the modification of the traditional Mackenzie River drift boat with the broad transom in about 1948. And Mechanics Illustrated, they used to publish special projects that accompanied their monthly or quarterly publications back in the 40s and 50s, did a story on the Rapid Robert. No one knows where the name Rapid Robert came from. It's not recognized on the Mackenzie River among the guides, but you get away from the Mackenzie River and people recognize that name rather quickly. And it has to do with the publication from Mechanics Illustrated, where it was project number 33, and it details the construction of the boat and really helped to popularize that boat type because it's a good dual-purpose boat. You know, you can navigate up to Class 3 water comfortably with it, put a motor on it,
yeah,
10 horse, and it'll actually get up and plane.
That's the big question I asked Joe about that. You know, I asked him about, like, can you get a drift boat up on plane, because I was thinking about that boat, and he said, you know, you can't because you need a flat plane area to get on plane, right? So that boat, I mean, it must have a flat planing area, but does it, I mean, how does it do in whitewater? So is that basically, if you get into, I mean, 3 versus 4, right? I mean, at what point do you swamp the boat?
Well, for a skilled oarsman, you can actually handle Class 4 water in that boat. And one of the tricks is in moving into into whitewater in a wave, a lot of guys who still, well, not a lot, there aren't many that use this particular boat anymore, but they would quarter into it. So they use one edge of the transom as kind of a prow to break through. And another problem with that particular boat is if you don't have enough momentum, you can slip back in, back down to a trough, and the boat will swamp very quickly. But again, for someone that knows what they're doing and has experience with it, you know, you can navigate class three water very carefully and
that's cool,
comfortably in class 4. I've taken that boat down the Rogue several times.
Oh, really? You've had it down the Rogue.
Yeah.
There you go.
And the Deschutes.
And the Deschutes. Have you on the Deschutes, have you been through the middle of Colorado Rapids ever, down through the big hole?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you have. Have you been through the middle of that in a drift boat?
No, I'm a little smarter than the average guy. I kind of slip off to the side.
Yeah, well, that's the big question, is that my dad has been through. He's got a pitcher going through the middle of Colorado in I think it's a Koffler. And he's punching it, and it looks like you're on the Grand Canyon. I mean, there's a wave of water coming over, and I've never done it again. I've been through it in a raft, but in a drift boat, I want to do that. You know what I mean? I like want to do it just to get the feel, because I know it would be kind of the, you know, again, I go back to those videos because the Grand Canyon dory stuff, I search, you know, I'll put a link in the show notes to this video, but there's one that shows this guy going into Lava Falls, which is one of the big rapids down there. And he's got these decked over, And we haven't talked about the decked over boats, but we'll dig into that maybe if we have time. Basically, they cover the whole inside of the boat with surface area. So when these huge waves hit, the water just floats off and then they can stay. But this guy comes in this humongous wave. I mean, these are huge. And it's slow motion, right? And it's also, and you could see the guy every little move. And I know whitewater pretty well. And I could see what he did wrong. You know what I mean? It's like, it's obvious when you see him flipping. I mean, you know, when you're in a rapid, it's tough, but he didn't turn straight into the wave. It was a side curl and he just was a little bit off and it pushed him. I mean, it just rolled him left. And I wonder that boat, because it has that flat bottom, was it more the fact that it's hard to turn those boats as fast as you need in some situations? And so like Martin Linton, right? He's known as the guy is like, just keep it straight and just go forward. Right.
Yep. Yep. I remember I've interviewed him several times.
Oh, you did. Wow.
And there were occasions when he just pulled the oar in his horse and said, well, that's all I can do, and ride it out.
Amazing.
He's very interesting. Very Amazing. Interesting guy.
Well, tell me that because, you know, briefly, Pete McBride, like I said, I had him on. I'll put a link to that episode as well. He talked about Martin, and I asked him the same question. I said, you know, Martin's this grizzled old, you know, guy who's protecting the Grand Canyon and drift boat. I mean, he started basically the Dories down there. I mean, give me a little snippet into Martin, into that interview. Like what surprised you about that guy? Why was he such a huge person to be around? Or was
because
he?
Because he was, he thought big, he did big. He was an environmentalist to the nth degree. I just really was impressed by his capacity to talk the talk. And not only in his life did he talk it, he walked it. And one of the reasons that people are able to run the Colorado from putting in at Lee's Ferry down to Lake Mead is because of that man. They were ready. In fact, I can't remember where it is on the Colorado. I'm one of these folks that dream about it, but never never been on the Colorado. He single-handedly led the charge to keep that dam from going in, and it would have basically destroyed any opportunity for people to experience the Grand Canyon as you experience it today.
Wow.
He in many ways, he was bigger than life. A fellow by the name of Brad Dimmick.
Yeah.
Hear him talk about it. In fact, Brad is interviewed on the McBride film, Martin's Boat. He gets pretty emotional, Brad does, about Martin and what he was able to do. He was a pilot. We had decided to rendezvous, I think it was in Albany, and he was flying over to Lewiston. And I think he was flying up until about the age of 86, 87, wow, something like that. And it was that and I think that was the same year he gave up the boat was the same year that he made his last run on the oars through lava.
Jeez.
At 87 years of age. Yeah. And just a very interesting guy.
So put that in perspective, Roger. You're about the same age as my dad, and I know, you know, these days when we're on the river, I'm usually taking my dad down, you know, because he's, you know, but I mean, talk about that. I mean, you're 82, right? Or in that range. I mean, think of running not only being on the river, but running a drift boat. I mean, what does that feel like to you if you were to have to do that right now?
I really think I could do it.
There you go.
But I do know that my strength is not what it used to be. But, you know, the trick to running a drift boat has to do with knowing the river and being a lot more anticipatory than you might be otherwise. There are oarsmen who I have come to admire greatly. A fellow by the name of Dave Hilfrich, his son Kenny Hilfrich, Willard Lucas down on the Rogue River. Willard was, to me, one of the most gifted an artful oarsman. He was able to read the current so well that you would rarely see him dip the oars And when he did, it was to position the boat and stay in a seam or in a current that just made it look so easy. And that's something I have tried to model in my own time on the oars. And I think probably I've lost some of that at 82. But I would certainly do it. Yeah. And my wife would probably have a fit. And my kids probably cheer me on. I would probably do it.
That's awesome. All right. Well, stay tuned. I'm gonna be working my, as I dig into this more, maybe I'll have an opportunity for maybe you or us to get out there. I'll check back with you because I'm kind of excited about, you know, putting something together as well. I've been talking about it, and you know, like I said, I'm kind of addicted to those videos. But let's and you mentioned a couple people, Brad Dimmick, who I'm going to be having on, and as well as Kenny Helfrich. Both of those guys I've talked to, they're going to come on and fill in some of the gaps that we probably don't cover here. But I wanted to bring it back to Heinemann because Joe, you know, I mentioned Koffler. I asked Koffler where that boat design comes from, and he said he thought it was a Heinemann boat, which kind of makes sense, 1935. But take us back. So I think we were in the you know, chronologically in the 1940s, drift boat, 1948. I mean, were there other people there from Heinemann on that we could talk about here that really impacted drift boats?
Yeah, certainly Keith Steele. Well, yeah, you know, I haven't said much about Tom Carhuis. Goodman Carhuis went by the name of Tom, immigrated to this country in 1909, ultimately ended up in Eugene and worked in a mill and had a woodcrafter's shop and built occasional boats, drift boats. He was basically the person that innovated plywood as a construction material of choice for drift boats. And it wasn't until 1938-ish that the phenoxy resin, the glue that held this material together, was of sufficient quality as to not deteriorate, that he began to build these drift boats out of plywood. And he was the first to offer a drift boat kit where he would provide the material and might form a few of the oars, cut the side panels, cut the transom, stem post. And then the boat builder, and most of these people were guides looking for efficient and inexpensive ways to build their own boats. He basically was the innovator relative to the use of plywood in boat construction. Until plywood came along, you're pretty much limited to the material that you had, and that's why the old scow remained the old scow for so long. You can only bend those planks so far. Plywood, it's amazing. People don't realize that a side panel on a contemporary wood drift boat is only a quarter inch thick or 5 millimeters, depending on the material you're using. That's not much material, but those things hold up very, very well. And if you were to bang into a rock, it's not necessarily the side panel that will take the damage. One of the frame may fracture a frame. I do a lot of modeling of these boats. You know, people are interested in them. And I have on two occasions inadvertently dropped a model I was working on. I had all the frames on, and when it fell, I stepped to get out of the way, and I'd be darned if it didn't step right on it. And the darn thing held up. I saw that as a reflection of the material and method of construction. Yeah,
that's amazing. That's the thing. Your models that you create are essentially their exact replicas of a full size drift boat. So it would be like if there was some giant alien thing that stepped on a drift boat with, you know, hundreds of thousands of pounds and didn't squish it. But these boats, I mean, talk about that a little bit. I mean, have you ever run into a rock so hard that you thought, or have you put a rock through the boat of your actual boat?
I haven't.
Have you ever talked to anybody that any recent?
Oh, Recently, or just in the last, whatever your life, have you talked?
You've seen people that have put holes in wood drift boats.
It happens. It happens. I've seen boats that took a rock head on and cracked the stem post and separated the panel from the stem post. I've seen boats that have taken the rock through the side panel on the Rogue. There's a rapid below Blossom Bar called Staircase, and there's a really strong eddy on the right hand side. And so when you take that stretch, you want to be left, not get trapped in that eddy, because if you do, it's just real effort to get out of it. And a friend of mine, we were on a trip one time, misgauged his place and got caught in that eddy and he was going into the wall, and so he lifted the oar blade up to fend it off the wall. Well, the force, the current took that boat right in, and that loom of the oar went right straight down and through the off side panel on the left hand side. So all kinds of things can happen, and you know, a quarter inch or 5 millimeter plywood has its limitations, but I'm just amazed at the strength of these boats. And
that's crazy.
And one of the reasons why it really pays to become, you know, I get a lot of people who buy the book and build a boat from the book. And one of my cautions has always been, if you've not been on a river before, you really need to find someone that can tutor you or provide some guidance and counsel. Just don't jump in that boat and head on down. It's a different world. It's very different than rowing one of these boats on a lake. Very different.
Yeah.
And so there are dangers that you need to be very aware of and avoid. And you know, I'm not to pat myself on the back, but I have never had a mishap in a drift boat. And I attribute that to exercising great care, knowing what I'm doing. And regardless of how familiar I am with a particular rapid, you know, I'll get out and scout. Whitehorse on the Deschutes is always something you got to scout. The Blossom. Occasionally, Tyee on the Road, but certainly Blossom Bar. And it just makes a lot of sense to exercise great care.
Yeah, no, and you mentioned, like I said, Helfrich, the Helfrich family, they run the Middle Fork of the Salmon River that I've done, not in a drift boat, but I remember when I ran that river in a raft, I remember seeing those drift boats being like, man, those guys are in wood boats. This is like intense. I'm like struggling, you know, I mean, it's pretty crazy. But hey, I did want to touch on this wood versus aluminum versus fiberglass, because you know, we have these wood boats that were the first boats around, but eventually aluminum boats came in. And can you talk about that change, and then also where fiberglass fits in there in the history and how we came? Because it seems like now wood boats, because, you know, you can't leave them outside, are not the most common boats you see. It seems like maybe it's aluminum or fiberglass.
Mm-hmm. I can't speak to fiberglass very authentically. However, aluminum, as fiberglass does, I'm sure, makes a lot of sense, because the maintenance required is minimal. Jerry Briggs built wood dories up until about 1980, and in 81 built his first aluminum Colorado River dory. And by the way, I'll take exception, Dave, to the utility of wood. I think wood has a great ability to stand up. Jerry built 35 dories for the Colorado. I haven't inquired of Brad for 2 or 3 years, but at the time the book was published, all 35 of those boats were still in use on the Colorado.
Well, you noted that basically you take exception to the fact that wood can't hold up, or you know, but I agree with that. I would say, you know, for people that don't have a garage to, you know, my aluminum boat sits out in the backyard literally all year long, and all I do is pull the plugs, tip it upside down. If I did that with a wood boat, what would that look like in a couple years?
Well, the water wouldn't be as much of a problem for the wood boat, you know, rain as sun. Ultraviolet rays create greater problems for wood than moisture does. And so obviously you do want to provide some kind of cover for a wood boat to protect it.
How long do you think if I had a wood boat, it was a brand new wood boat, and I just did that, I left it outside, it was in the sun, just said, how long would it take before, you know, you started to see some effects of, would that be like the first year that thing would be, you know?
Maybe 2 or 3 years before. And it would depend on the material. Some of these tropical panels hold up better than plywood. Plywood has always been my material of choice. But the problem with plywood, is that it will check. And it will check primarily because ultraviolet rays from the sun, not from the moisture. I don't have it now. I let it go to a fellow by the name of, Vintage Wooden Boat Tours over in Jackson, Wyoming, A.J. DeRosa. Had been after me for my boat, my original boat, which at the time was 55 years old and still very functional. And he wanted to add it to his collection of vintage wooden boats. That boat saw probably about 12 to 15 trips a year. Hmm. It would sit out a lot during the summer months. In the winter time, I would always provide protection from the rain primarily. But it got to checking so bad that during the period of time from when I quit winter steelhead fishing to getting back to fly fishing in the spring, particularly on the Deschutes, the wood would dry out, and I would have to then fill that boat with water about one third the way up, and it would sit. I'd let it sit for 2 or 3 days, and when I first do it, the darn boat looked like a sponge. Water would be just spitting out. Wow. all over the boat. But after 2 or 3 days, the wood would swell, tighten up like a drum.
Huh.
And I was good to go for the season.
Amazing.
And so one of the liabilities of wood is that it does expand and shrink depending on the amount of moisture that it has in the wood. Aluminum has many advantages, and one use site is probably the greatest advantage. And for these guides who are working out of their tackle box or out of their fly box, they've got to have a boat that requires little to no maintenance. A wood boat, it does take a little more care and attention to some detail. I think it's interesting, since my book was published, more and more of these things are appearing. You mentioned Kenny Helfrich. His dad, Dave Helfrich, was very helpful in pointing me and giving me some compass headings when I was doing my research back in the mid to late 90s and up until the book was published. And Dave had left wood behind years before for his outfitting. Since the book was published, and the utility of wood has been re-recognized, Kenny's operation has almost converted totally to wood and away from aluminum. If you were to take a trip with Helfrich River outfitters down the Middle Fork of Salmon, all but one or two of the 7 or 8 or 9 boats on that trip would be wood drift boats. Wood, the advantage to it is it's warm. It's very easy to maintain. And there's just something historically nostalgic about wood. But relative to the functionality of fiberglass and aluminum, wood boats can't compare.
Yeah. 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 No, and all. Like I said, I'm going to have Kenny on, and we'll dig more into all the history here. We don't have time to check in, and yeah, I agree. I mean, I have an old wood boat, old Ray's River Dory, that actually was my dad's, and he's given it to me. It's got like your boat, you know. It's not 1965 circa, but it's an old boat. It's been in a garage, but I'm wondering, like, you know, I want to, you know, again, we're not going to get into probably boat building here today, but, you know, I'm thinking about maybe redoing that thing, refinishing it and finding out, how do you know if you got an old boat, what would be the step to do to figure out whether it's worth the effort? Is there any boat that's just, how bad is too bad to think about refinishing?
that depends on the crazy guy that's going to restore the boat.
Yeah.
Well, I would find a good sharp awl, and I would try to penetrate the chine, the inside chine. It's that, I call it the keystone to a wooden boat.
What's an awl? Like a pointed, like a screwdriver or something like that, or a
very sharp point.
Sharp point.
And
okay.
You can dig into wood, press into wood, gotcha. And that will give you a way to look for dry rot.
Dry rot. Yeah.
If it slips in for fairly easily, you're probably slipping into dry rot, and that will tell you how extensive the dry rot might be. And also along the inside edges of the transom and the stem post. All that placed that reaches a point though where one might probably think, if I want a wood drift boat, maybe I'd be better off building one from scratch. It'd be a lot less work and a lot less labor intensive than restoring a boat.
Yeah.
But that's completely dependent on the person and the history behind the boat and the family nostalgia.
Exactly.
Type particular boat.
Exactly.
But I don't know of any wood drift boat that can't be repaired.
Good. Good. That's great to hear. Yeah, that's, for me, it's more nostalgia. It's my dad's old boat. It's the boat I remember. I've had plenty of steelhead and deer even hanging off the back of that boat over the years. And, I'd love to.
Well, if you go to chapter 11 in the book, it details the construction of these boats. And reviewing that, you can become very familiar with the integral parts of the boat and areas that you may need to pay attention to more than others. I don't know of any wood drift boat that can't be repaired. And that depends on the energy and the interest of the person looking to repair a boat.
Okay, perfect. Let's take it back really quickly back to the history again. Let's go way back to the start just for a second and say those first boats, before there was actually a drift boat, you know, they I guess Prince Helfrich or before him, they were running these boats. Where did those boats, what was that design? What was that first design and where did those come from?
Well, good question. I have a theory about that. These boats assumed the shape of what used to be called a log driver. You've been down the road. Have you stopped at Winkle Bar and gone up and taken a look at the cabin and then a look at the boat that's there?
Yep.
That old double ender is very much akin to the boat that plied McKinsey in the early days.
Oh, wow.
The log driver was designed and built and used in Maine to herd stampeding logs downriver and to haul men and gear and equipment upriver to logging camps. And it was a highly functional, useful boat. And that boat type migrated across the country and ultimately landed in Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. My notion is that boat type is what you see in that Zane Grey boat at Winkle Bar. And without the transom of the boat on the McKinsey, it would very much look like that log driver. And because we are a population of immigrants into this area, it's logical that people's familiarity with boats who had inclinations and interests in those boats would be expressed in boats built here. So my theory is that, I don't think can ever be proven, but my theory is that the boat types on the McKinsey and the Rogue, the very earliest boat types, were influenced by the log driving bateau.
There you go. So that goes back to that New England or that old, that thought that you hear that. Some people say, yeah, maybe, I don't know, it started. But it's still, you think of it as the drift boat as being an Oregon boat.
Oh, yeah.
No,
and that's one of the things that has so intrigued me about that boat. The spawning grounds all these boats that you see around the country are the Mackenzie and the Rogue River. I consider them Oregon's very unique design as a contribution to small boat design in the country. They didn't start on any other river in the country. I get a couple letters emails with pictures from people that have built a boat from my book. And my guess is that from around the world, most recently from Tasmania.
Oh, wow.
That's just south of Australia. And the thing is, these boats are so highly functional. And the boats that are represented in the book are historic representations of the boats at each point in the evolution of those boats. People are building these boats and using them as fishing platforms. The two boats that have seen the least amount of building are the Lightboard and Batten boat by Velty Pruitt and that old Scout. Well, and also the lines to the Zane Grey boat at Winkle Bar also in the book. There have been maybe two or three boats of each built over the last 13 years.
Yeah.
But the Mackenzie River double ender with the transom and the Rogue River Dory and the Colorado River Dory.
Yep.
They are very popular and yeah. People are building these from the book. Yeah.
That's right. Okay, cool. And well, there's lots of stuff here we're leaving on the table as far as any of the little details of any of these people. But I mean, before we start to think about heading out, is there, any other people? You mentioned Zane Grey. Are there any other people we want to highlight that had a big impact on, on the history of boats? We were at Heinemann, right? Was in that area.
Yeah.
Anybody else we haven't talked about that had a big impact on drift boat evolution?
Let me think.
I mean, we got the book. So I if you want to check it out, and where is a good place to go for that book? I guess, is that something just to go to Amazon, or where would you recommend they pick up that book?
You can do that. If they go to Amazon and just do a search in Amazon using the title of the book, Drift Boats and River Dories, it'll pop up and they can get it there. I've got a run on books here for the holidays. They can get it through me at riversdutch.com. And they'd get a signed copy. And then, there may be some retailers who listen to your podcast, fly fishing shops and other retailers. The main distributor west of the Mississippi for this book is Angler's Book Supply in Eugene, filled by Mark Koenig. And for retailers that may be interested in having the book on a shelf for sale, could go there and get the discount that they can make a few bucks on the retail price.
Oh, cool. All right. And what about, again, going back all the people, is there one person? I know there's people along the way that had huge influences, but if you just say who was the biggest influence on drift boats, what would you say to that question?
It would be Woody Heinemann.
Oh, really?
Well, he basically innovated the double ender and ultimately the double ender with a transom. And there are some very interesting stories behind how that double ender with a transom came about, and an interesting story on how it was he decided to go with a double ender as opposed to a broad transom.
Well, that's the question. So just briefly on that. So a double ender, when I think of a double ender, it's got the two points on both ends.
Right.
How do you have a transom in on that as well? Because I thought the transom is the place to hold the motor.
It is. Well, the double ender with a transom is no longer a true double ender because it has a transom on the stern portion of the boat. But the reason Woody decided to redesign that big square-ended boat with the broad transom related to his very first trip down the Middle Fork in August of 1939. He ran into areas where that boat would pitch right or left, and one rapid, he never named it, he swung the boat around and went down through that water prow first, point of section first, and the idea hit him. Well, that's a lot easier than going down with this big, broad transom. going down transom first. And so he came back in that winter. He essentially took that that broad transom boat and replicated the frames that go toward the bow toward the stern of the boat and came up with this true double ender. Because plywood was manufactured, the greatest length you can get was 14 feet. His first double ender was a 14 footer. That's around the shear line of the boat, ended up being about 13 feet. But it wasn't until the end of the war that 16 foot panels became available and started building 16 foot double enders, which became his boat of choice. And the fellow that wanted a transom, he wanted the upriver end of his boat replaced with a transom in order to hang a motor on it. That was 1948. Woody was opposed to it, but he did it anyway. And it's ironic that that's the boat that has become the boat of choice for most wood boat drifters.
That's it.
It's an interesting story.
Yeah, that is, and that's the 16 by 48 inch boat is mainly that way because back then that's what plywood came in, right? That's why they stuck with that size.
Exactly. And the technology for scarfing material together to come up with a 54, 56, or 50, 57 inch wide boat just wasn't available there.
Yeah.
And these boats are very efficient to build. Now you go 1648, you can get two side panels for that boat out of 1 4 by 16 foot length of a quarter inch plywood.
Yeah, that's huge. And then what about, so on the Grand Canyon, so those boats were wood too, but those weren't six. Didn't they build like 17 or 18 foot bigger boats? How did they do that?
The width on the boats at the Chine did not exceed the 4 foot width until the technology became available to scarf that stuff together to come up with a wider bottom. But yeah, they tend to be longer. The traditional Rogue River Dory or Rogue River Special measured out at about 17 feet stem to stern, and it was that boat type and the footprint of that boat that became the footprint for the Colorado River Dory.
Just wider.
Used to build. Yeah. Well, it isn't wider. It's a little wider maybe at the shear, but the 4 foot bottom remained, I think, through the time until he started building the aluminum boats. And they might have built those boats with a little greater width.
Oh, wow.
The bottom.
That's cool.
But the length was greater.
I actually posted, it was interesting, Roger. I posted, I should have asked you first. I did cite your book and gave you a shout out. I don't think you're on Instagram, but I posted I took a screenshot of your book with my phone. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to think of where the boat it was, but it was one of Martin Linton's, I believe. It was the one that looks like there's two coffins next to the rower. Do you know the boat design I'm talking about?
By coffins.
Yeah, there's this one. I think Martin. It was the boat. It was the Martin's boat. The one that didn't last. Like, let's see. I think I have it right here. I noted. This was here's the thing I said I threw out another throwback pick and it says Martin Linton's son was sitting in the boat in the photo.
And
I've got do you know what I'm talking about?
That's the one he built, I think, for that was Martin's. There were two boats. One he built had built for Pat Riley. You're talking about the very earliest boat, and his son is sitting in the boat.
Yep.
On the trailer.
Yep.
Yeah. Keith built those compartments for Martin. Pat Riley took the hull of the boat and built his own compartments. And I can't remember what the differences were, if any, between his and Martin's.
Well, that's the big one when you look at it. It looks like there's a couple of coffins sitting next to you. And I think if you're rowing down the boat, you don't want to be thinking about death, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, from inside the boat, the tops of those compartments actually sloped toward the rowing well. And Jerry had a way that he designed a special scupper that would allow the footwell of the rower to drain so he wouldn't have to be preoccupied with bailing. But you can't do that for the passengers up front or the passengers in the back. They basically have to bail like heck to lighten up the boat after they go through a place like Upset or like Lava.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, the fun fact on that is that I posted that on Instagram, and you can track, you know, with I could track all the insights. I can see how many people liked it and stuff. And out of all of my photos that I've done in like the history of my Instagram, that old crappy screenshot I took of a gray and white drift boat is number one.
So it just shows
you that there's some, maybe that's saying something about my Instagram, but it's also saying something that people are interested in this, you know, some old boat. And I'll link out to that as well, so everybody can take a look, or they can just buy your book and actually get the real photo.
Okay. that is one in the boat.
Yeah.
In the book.
Well, yeah, Roger, like I said, there's definitely a lot we left on the table. I'll try to fill the gaps or maybe direct people, you know, your way if there's questions. You know, anything, I mean, I guess one thing, you know, drift boats for sale, that's another topic that comes up a lot when you search for drift boats. Where would you, if somebody wanted to buy a wood boat or just a drift boat in general, where would you send that person?
Well, if they wanted a new one, I'd send them to one of the very few builders remaining. Ray's River Dories. Ray's retired. Cyrus Happy is retired. And a fellow by the name of David, I think it's Hayes, has taken over. And he's building boats. And he still goes under the name of Ray's River Dories. There's a younger fellow in his, I think he might have just turned 40. Jason Hayes, down on the McKenzie, builds a really nice drift boat. He hasn't started to kit them yet. And then you've got to go over into Montana, and the builders over there, except for one, are Stitch and Glue. If you're looking for a decent used boat, there's a website called Wooden Boat. Oh dear. Wooden Boat People.
Oh, cool.
And if they do a search for wooden boat people, you will come in contact with a whole bunch of people that are restoring boats, building boats, looking for boats, and it's quite a forum for wooden boat aficionados. And you got to sign up to be a part of the group, but it's well worth it. It's really a
Facebook
excellent
group.
Forum. Yeah.
Yep. And what about, this is another name that came up. I remember back in college, this was a name I remember hearing, is Don Hill Boats. What happened? Who was that guy? Because he seemed like he's a pretty big wood boat builder.
Yeah, he was. And he kind of redesigned the McKenzie so that it had a little more breadth from the rowing seat to the bow in order to more adequately accommodate two fishermen up front. He never liked the idea of someone fishing out of the boat behind him and in front of him. He wanted to be sure to be able to manage the clients better.
Was he not a fly fisherman?
Yeah, he was, but he was not restricted. It would depend on what the client wanted to do. And a lot of these guys aren't really excited about having people stand up and swinging their flies around. A lot of them will put the flies out in front of the boat and trail them, and then the oarsman will manage the boat in order to try to position those flies for hits by steelhead or whatever it is fishing for.
That's right.
But Don Hill was very pretty popular. He died here about 5 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
And he's basically out of business now. Well, obviously he's out of business, but his website, DH Drift Boats, is still up, and someone has taken over his business.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I've not met him, but.
Yeah. Cool. Awesome. Yeah. That's great. All right. Yeah. There's obviously like I said, there's probably some other people we're leaving off here, but I'll just, as I keep going on my journey, this is only the second interview I've had in this drift boat series. So I've got a whole bunch of, you know, people coming up, like I said, some Grand Canyon folks. Just a couple ones before we get out of here. You know, maybe these are a little more, you know, kind of bigger questions, but, you know, the Grand Canyon, I'm curious because I've never run it. And, you know, and I plan on getting you out there, but I mean, do you have any regrets, you know, not running the Grand Canyon?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And it's not because I haven't had the interest, nor it's not because I haven't had the opportunity. I'm one of these rare individuals that has a condition called cryoglobulinemia. And it's a protein that, when subjected instantly to cold, the blood tends to gel up very quickly and moves much less efficiently through the body. And so, you know, if I were to dump, it's really cold water, there's a 10, 20, 30% chance that I wouldn't, that I'd be hit by this before I'd be able to get out of the water and warmed up. So
I gotcha.
My wife, who for some reason has stuck with me now for 60, it'll be 60 years next August.
Wow.
She's been pretty adamant. I don't want. Brad Dimmick has invited me to join his group on a couple of occasions. Andy Hutchinson.
Yeah.
So it's not that I haven't had the opportunity.
There you go.
It's a little too risky.
There you go. Yeah, I'm hoping. That makes sense. Obviously, there's, we want to keep you around, you know, for sure. So I hear that. I just want to note quickly on the Emerald Mile, and you mentioned a couple people, Brad Dimmick, and, I mentioned Kevin Fedarko, who wrote that book. I will put a link out to that as well, because that was an awesome book and talks about those guys that, the premise is those guys that ran, I think they ran the Grand Canyon, was it like 90,000 CFS?
It was very high.
Yeah, it was some crazy amount.
Right. It was very unusual.
It was very unusual. Yeah, they're trying to break the speed record, and they think they broke it that trip by like 10 hours. But one of the crazy stories in it was literally going down through Crystal. Crystal was this huge rapid, but then because of the flows, the wave was like 30 feet tall or some crazy, and they dumped their boat. They're on this trip. They dumped their boat. And that's the great thing about these decked over boats is it seems crazy to me that, God, you dump this boat and the drift boat's still floating. The guy breaks his nose. They manage to flip it back over, hop back in the boat, and they finish the trip and they break the record. So, you know what I mean? Like, what would you say? Have you read the Emerald Bower? Do you know that story?
In fact, Kevin was in touch with me several times while he was writing the book, and he was interested in the construction of the boats. And in his book is a schematic from my plans for the Colorado River dory, basically the Brigsian dory. And I couldn't wait for it to come out. I'll tell you, it is a marvelous book. I've recommended it to a number of people and have bought it as gifts to some friends. And he does a great job of setting the stage meteorologically as to why this big flow occurred. And these guys that made that run, they could have suffered some dire consequences legally because the river had been shut down and they were not to have launched. But they figured out a way to do it and they did it.
I know. Yeah, no, it's great. That's great. Okay. All right, Roger. Well, hey, in today, this conversation, anything you want to leave everybody with? We didn't talk about the building of the boat, but what would be your, everything we talked about today, any take-home messages for somebody who's still listening?
Well, I guess one, I wouldn't decry wood. Its warmth and whatnot makes for a really fine boat, and the sharp chine makes it highly maneuverable. As far as the book's concerned, anyone that buys the book and is so inclined can build any one or more of the 9 or 10 boats that are the plans and construction detail are provided in the book.
Yeah.
But there's one story I want to tell real quickly. You asked about Grasshopper and if I ever took it head on. I have a friend who was a counselor. He's not with us anymore. Would take a client who was ready to experience some risk down the Deschutes, and his preference was to hit that big trough and up over that stack head on. And as they would approach it, this one client says, well, we can slip safely to the right or we can take it head on. And he says, well, let's take it head on. He says, I think I'm ready for this. So they take it head on. And the pitch of the boat was so great that Clyde lost grip of the oars and was actually pitched out of the boat. And they hit those diminishing waves as they went through. But he was out of the boat and managed to climb back in the boat and in very exhausted state and grabbed the oars. And the guy up front turned around and said, boy, Clyde, you did that really well.
Wow.
I had no idea. I'd been pitched out of the boat.
Amazing. That is so cool. Yeah. I've seen that before. I've actually seen a raft, a couple people in our group that did the same thing. They've seen them pitched upside down. I've seen, my brother has this story, same thing. I think he was going through there and he got flung out, was hanging on to the oar on the outside of the boat. And so, it's just, I think, I haven't been down the Colorado, but I think that wave, and I'm sure that's why it was named that, right? But I'm sure that wave is comparable to some of the bigger waves in the Colorado.
It's a huge one. Now I always chose discretion over, I don't know, either valor or what, but I'd sneak along the right side.
I mean, my biggest thing is, I think you got gear. I've actually been upside down, not in a drift boat. I flipped a raft down there one time, and that's definitely a crazy feeling. But that's the thing. You have your gear for 4 or 5 days or something. You fill your boat up. And I've done that one time actually in Whitehorse. I filled up an old Fisherite boat, about 2 feet of water in the bottom of the boat. And we barely pulled it to shore before swamping in the next wave. But, that's a reality, right? That's the problem. I would take, my goal is, I think, to buy a decked out boat for the Colorado and then, for the river, for the Grand Canyon, then take it down to the Deschutes just to see, right?
All right. You would find it a wonderful experience, I'm sure.
So there you go. If you want to find all the show notes with all links we covered, just go to wetflyswing.com/177. I would love if you can leave a quick rating and review. You can head over to wetflyswing.com/love to leave a review. I wanted to, before we head out here today, leave a read a quick review that was recently written by McFallon. And it goes 5 stars. I never write reviews, but this deserves ones. I want to see this podcast continue to succeed. You've got great guests, good format, and clearly care about your topics. Keep it up. McFarland from the United States. Hey, I said McFarland. I was thinking of somebody else, but McFallon. Definitely appreciate you taking the time to leave a review. This is amazing, and I read everyone. Like I said, you can go to wetflyswing.com/love to leave a rating interview. I want to thank you in advance if you have a chance to do that. So I have to take a deep breath after that one. Drift boats, I think Roger did a great job giving us a start. There's so much to dig into. I'm going to continue digging into these drift boats as I continue interviewing founders, guides, drift boat building, just as I want to get this side little series buttoned up and covering everything, so we kind of know what's going on. It's my interest, and I hope you're really enjoying it as well. If you want to leave some feedback, again, hit the speak pipe link, because if you have something in the drift boats that I haven't covered, or have something that you want to make sure I cover on this thing, it'd be a great place to do it there. If you have a connection to drift boats, that would also be awesome to leave some sort of a voice message. I want to thank you again today for stopping by to check out the show. I'm looking forward to catching up with you soon. Hope to maybe see you on the river or online.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com. And if you found this episode helpful, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes.